Hey, this is Chris, and welcome to Module 3 of Design Thinking and Doing for Social Innovation. In this module, we're going to be exploring the question, what is? This podcast is coming to you from unceded Kaurna land. I'd like to pay my respects to elders past, present, and future. And indeed, the elders on the lands on which you're listening today. The First Nations peoples of Australia are some of the most heavily researched people in the world. And they're unfortunately very used to being engaged in research processes on others' terms that lead to little benefit to them. In this module, we'll be exploring how to shape your research processes so that they are respectful, useful, and set up opportunities for real change. In the last module, we talked about power, participation, and trust. And in the what is stage, all of that's going to come to life as you start to recruit participants, make promises to them about what they will and will not be able to influence and decide in your process. And you also have to think about how to create safe and creative spaces that take into account any specific considerations for the groups that you're working with. Also in the last module, we introduced the four diamond design process. The first diamond was what project? The second, what is? The third, what if? And the fourth, what works? This module is going to pick up at the point at which you start thinking about the what is diamond, which is probably going to be in the latter stages of the what project diamond. And then we're going to go all the way to the point at which the what is diamond overlaps with the what if diamond, where you start identifying opportunities based on your research that can provide a jumping off point for creative solutions in the next stage. There's a lot that needs to happen in the what is diamond. In the divergent phase, you need to scope what's already known about the situation and potential solutions, so that you're starting from a strong base and not redoing work that's already been done. Then, you need to decide on a small number of key research questions, and these will provide your focus throughout the what is diamond, right up until the end. Then, with your questions defined, you need to think about the best research approach, combining conventional research methods with design research methods. Now, you need to develop your design research approach in detail to think about the cohorts of people that you want to engage, developing and testing your research tools and planning your approach to documentation. Now you know your methods, you need to plan how to recruit respondents for the research, how to inform them about what this is all about, how to incentivize and reward their participation through payment or other means, and how to let them opt in or out of participation at any point. Ethics is a factor that often comes into play at this point, and it can be a real range of activity dependent on what's required and expected in the systems that you're working in. And then, with all of these plans in place, you start to get to recruit actual people to take part in your fieldwork. And then when you've got your people, you can start to do your fieldwork, and at this point everything starts to open up as you start to learn more and more and more about your key questions. And only now, having done those eight steps that I've already explained, you start to move into the convergent mode of thinking. So far, you've added more data to the problem, you've made the problem bigger. Now your role is to make sense of it by returning to your key questions, sorting the data against them, and spotting patterns and outliers. The finishing flourish for the what is stage is to articulate what you've learned about opportunities to do something better or different. And to do that in a way that excites people about the potential of responding to these opportunities and starts to stimulate their imagination of how to respond in the what if diamond. And there's just one more step, but it's often neglected: closing the loop with your research participants and letting them know what's come of their time and effort and energy and the sharing of their stories and ideas. The what is stage of design thinking and doing processes nearly always includes aspects of conventional research alongside design research activities. They complement each other. Existing literature can give a good general insight into existing problems and illustrate opportunities for solutions. Design research can then build on this by validating that research in the context that you're working in, or by extending it, or by making it more specific to context and the particular cohorts in focus, but also by challenging it through new insights into the situation. Most social research has been done at the level of what people do, say, and think. It's based on what people know they know for the most part. Some research does get deeper into what people actually do rather than what they say they do. And it's at this sort of level that design research can start to add real value through observative methods that can help us understand what do people actually do or how do services actually work. Things like rapid ethnographies or service ethnographies. In addition to that, particular kinds of talking and making methods, often called generative methods, that aim to get at what people know, feel, dream, and value. Henry Ford may once have said, "If I would have asked my customers what they would have wanted, they would have said a faster horse." But he understood that his customers got value from getting from A to B more quickly. If I'd asked you 25 years ago if a mobile phone would be essential to your life today, you'd probably say no. But the companies at the time understood that we value communication on the go if it's convenient enough. So design research is not strictly about understanding what is, but also things like what people value and desire, things that can point to what could be in the future.
Yeah, so for us, we have a very clear sort of that's quite a bit of work that we put up front to make sure kind of getting the kind of scope of a question we're trying to answer quite clear.
And this is Ash Aluri, one of our most experienced practitioners at Taxi.
Kind of then layered into that.
A common failure point of design research is in the making sense and opportunity shaping steps that come at the end. In the worst of these situations, I've seen design teams become overwhelmed with data, transcripts, recordings, videos, and they just don't know how to wade through it all, don't know what's relevant, and making sense of that fieldwork becomes such a monumental task that it steals time away from the rest of the project. And most often, that's the creative work that should come in the what-if stage. When that's been the case, it's most often because there wasn't enough work on the earliest stages of the what is diamond to establish a set of key questions to focus the research. I can't overemphasize the rigor of planning required for good design research work. What I've learned from my colleagues who are specialists in this work is that with a clear set of focusing questions, a good sense of where you want to end up, and a pragmatic approach to documentation, design research can become self-driving. Set it up well, and you can trust the process to deliver. How many key questions should you have? Well, I'm going to say just three. You can have sub-questions, but really focusing in on three lines of inquiry will help you clarify your research collection and sense-making. My first project in Australia was something called the Family Project, from which came our family by family service. In the what is stage, we used a real vast range of methods. We did literature reviews, we carried out rapid ethnography with families, we hung out in families' homes, we did generative sessions with families over dinner, we shadowed services. But we were able to do that diversity of work because we knew there were three questions that we needed to keep coming back to. What is family life like? What do families aspire to? What do their families see as thriving? And what do families see as helpful and unhelpful help? And I'll let you into a little secret about design research. I think most design research projects actually seek to answer the same set of questions. And they're something like this. Well, first of all, you need to know what cohorts are in focus. Usually you're thinking about who are the beneficiaries of a particular service and policy, who are the funders, who are the deliverers of a particular service and policy. Then for each of those groups, you want to answer these questions. What's their context? Who supports them? What are their needs? What do they see as value or as success in the future? What helps and hinders them in achieving that? And what would create greater value for them? These questions about what is, but also about what could be.
We're back with Lucy Fraser here, and we're talking about recruitment. Everybody's favourite part of the process.
Yeah, that's where you get to meet some cool people. There's lots of different things that we've used, especially in COVID times as well, moving to some online recruitment. But we do often start with networks. So we are reliant on our own networks and also our partners' networks. And we often do some snowballing where we connect with some people and then ask them to pass the message on to people that they might know. We also do some promotion on social media, on people's websites, where we think people might be hanging out, try to reach them where they're at. And I guess we sort of try to target those messages to what people might be interested in about participating and the value that they might get out of joining us, not just what we want to hear from them. So we really sort of prioritize messages that talk about what they will be contributing to and any compensation for their time or any other sort of value that they'll be getting out of participating.
In this specific project, we actually led with contacting the schools through each state and territory's specific assisted or supported or specialist school transport system. So we went through a bit of a bureaucratic process to make sure that the families we were contacting were comfortable to connect with us through the relationships they had and so on. So,
well, I've definitely spent a lot of time in Footscray Library doing recruitment, inviting people to come in and chat to us. So we promoted some roles through community leaders and religious organisations for South Sydney's Australian young people. And then we were hanging out in the library and asked them to come along and talk to us if they were interested in the role. So we got to use the Wi-Fi, hang out. There's a lovely courtyard there, can recommend. And people had the chance to ask us some questions. And we also, were really clear about the tough topics that people might cover. And that helped them to figure out if the role was for them as well.
So at the time, I was already working with a group of young people. And so from my sort of caseload of about 80, I sort of rallied in about 8 to 10 young people to say, would you like to be involved in this? We'd love your opinion. You're the experts in this. And we invited them to a couple of workshops where we put on lunch. We remunerated them for their time. I think just made them feel extremely worthwhile that it was actually them that had to provide us with the advice and not the other way around.
Yes, so for some work that we did recruiting people with lived experience of gambling harm, we did some online recruitment. So we had messages on different service provider platforms as well as state government platforms inviting people to join in. And those were really visual and engaging with just people on the front saying, this could be anybody. If you relate to this, come along. And just targeting some particular groups by having LGBTQIA plus friendly like flags, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander flags, and just really friendly and approachable language that was non-judgmental, non-shaming, about, hey, this might be, like, you might have had this experience or someone close to you, like many other people, and we'd love to know more about that. We've also done some work recently which was more relational recruitment in mental health experiences, where we started with inviting some senior leaders, I suppose, in both professional and lived experience roles, who then decided who they thought they should recruit. So it was really their knowledge and expertise around who to prioritise in recruitment to be on a co-design group in that situation. So we supported them to reach out to their networks and to share messages that clearly explained what the commitment was and what we were hoping to achieve to send out to their networks as well. So that was more of a relational approach.
Another example of how we have conducted research with victim survivors of family and domestic violence was we created these very sort of, I guess, compassionate posters that we put into a number of family and domestic violence service sectors around Brisbane, inviting people to make an anonymous call to me, where we would ask them a few questions about their experiences within primary health, and we would, of course, give them a voucher for their time. I had probably about 9 or 10 really in-depth interviews that were completely anonymous. I didn't even need to ask for people's names. We sort of had a bit of a verbal contract in that first instance, because obviously safety and confidentiality for some of those people is critical. But I think just going out there and saying we'd like to do anonymous research and honour you through money and honour your story really helped us to actually understand some very deep insights that supported the development of the model with Brisbane South PHN.
A broad spread, but in terms of how we choose, it's quite strict on what are the things that we're looking to learn first. And based on that, then this also kind of comes down to, yeah, do you have enough budget? Like, how much time and scope do you have? So a lot of those factors are considered into who we choose to connect with, in how many locations, and then from what backgrounds and experiences and so on.
Closely related to choosing your design research methods is identifying the different groups of participants that you want to include in the research. The aim of design research is to answer your key questions and identify a number of potential opportunities to improve the situation. To do that, you typically spend hours or days going deep with a relatively small number of people, in contrast to a small amount of time with a large number of people. Often, samples for design research are in the range of 8 to 12 carefully chosen people. You're not looking to create statistical relevance through this work, but identify opportunities that have really high validity. Once you've identified these opportunities, you can then validate them with a large group of people using survey methods, if you need to. Sometimes, more people need to be included in a sample so that the sample's got perceived validity as well as actual validity. For example, when working on a national program that cuts across all states and territories, where every state wants to ensure that their people have been included.
So in this specific specialist school transport, so where we were trying to imagine a national service or design a national service, learning from the experiences of young people living with disabilities, accessing schools all around Australia in different contexts, we had to, because it was a national effort, we had to get a really diverse sort of sample set. So it was, at the end, it ended up becoming about 24 families or 24 families, with each family having maybe one child living with a disability or two or three. And so that was, we also then broke it down into locations. So keeping an urban metro sort of context, keeping a regional rural context and a rural remote context and a very remote context. So there was a lot of, I think with national projects or statewide projects in a jurisdiction, it's always important that they make some of these decisions covering all kind of cross sections of society. So sometimes they even break it down into, okay, are we kind of connecting with our First Nations, and what's their experience like in the communities they're living in? Are we connecting with our culturally, linguistically diverse cohorts, because they tend to live in the kind of outer suburbs, and also their access points are a bit different and their needs are a bit different, because language issues and other things add to the complexity of, let's say, just a physical or psychosocial or cognitive disability or intellectual disability. So for us, we argued for about 6 or 8 families per location. And we would always make sure that we are recruiting for upwards close to 10 or 12, just so that we had a backup for some of that.
For design research for social innovation, we typically aim to recruit a range of people across a number of key characteristics. Common dimensions include a diversity of abilities, physical and or cognitive, a diversity of cultural identity, including Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and culturally and linguistically diverse groups, a diversity of sexual and gender identity, a diversity of outcomes from poor to very good, a diversity of geography, metro, regional, very remote, a diversity of age, and often a diversity of attitudes or behaviours specific to the project in hand. For example, if you're working on housing, you might be interested in learning from people that have particularly individualistic tendencies versus folks that have more communal approaches to living. Alongside this, we're also likely to introduce some screening factors to ensure that participation is safe enough for the people taking part. For example, are people far enough from a traumatic experience in the past to talk about it now? It can be hard to get a perfect spread across the kind of multidimensional matrix we're talking about. And that's going to be complicated by the fact that you may not know where somebody fits on that matrix in advance. And that may well be because asking for that information in advance is a great way to sour a relationship. A typical approach is to use a number of recruitment strategies to find people that potentially represent different characteristics across your matrix. Conduct fieldwork with them and then work out where they fit in the matrix before trying to fill in the gaps through the next set of participants. Like prototyping and the design process itself, the research process is iterative. A particularly valuable group of participants are the positive deviants, people doing surprisingly well. For example, the young man who grew up in a violent gang but is now going to university, or the mum who got out of a domestic violence relationship and built herself and her kids back up from that. In many of the projects I've worked on at Taxi, the insight into what a new solution could be comes from finding, observing, and talking to positive deviants, identifying the factors that enabled them to do surprisingly well, and then developing a way to replicate those factors for others. So seek them out.
So another thing that's important when recruiting people is to just be really clear what they are committing to and what they might be exposed to and taking part as well. So often people might be going out and hearing some stories that might be similar to their own experience or some really tough things that they hadn't heard before. So we need to make sure that people are aware of that and can make an informed decision about taking part, whether they are ready to and feel safe and brave to. And we also need to, on our side as facilitators, make sure that we also feel that people are in a good space to do this work. So we do make some judgment calls about that. And we have used some particular processes to be quite, intentional about that, not just an emotional decision, but sort of going through and seeing if people are feeling like they're sort of currently going through a tough time or if they're feeling distanced enough from some of those tough times to be able to do this kind of work. And we've had the support of psychologists in the past to help us with that. And just also getting to know people a bit better around that helps us set up the safety and supports that might mean that people can contribute even if they're, not in the best place at the moment, but are still really interested and excited to take part, because that can also be part of someone's recovery or someone having a good experience and validating some tough stuff that they've been through before.
Recruitment for participatory projects deserves a special mention. Participatory projects being where there's a real shared power around decision making and folks with lived experience are present as part of the design team and also as part of governance for a particular project. So this same approach to recruitment can be used to recruit people for your design team and for your governance team. The difference is that this needs to happen back in the what project stage. The advantage of this approach is that when it comes to design research stage, you can start to utilize those people's knowledge and networks to connect with your research participants. For example, we commonly ask members of participatory design teams to conduct research with their peers. It doesn't work for everybody, but in some cases, this can lead to really rapid turnarounds in terms of collecting evidence and really rich insights.
Yeah, I guess in terms of recruiting and getting consent for people in shorter term interactions. So it might be taking part in a conversation or a one-off workshop or something like that. I think having really clear and transparent information up front to commit, but then we've used consent forms that are quite plain language and very visual, so using illustrations of cameras or note-taking or whatever permissions you might be asking for, and having a very sort of clear yes and no box on those pieces of paper to enable that to be clear to people and to make their decisions very clear, because we know that lengthy consent forms can be really challenging and really inaccessible to people. So as conversational and as plain language as we can.
Effective recruitment requires you to step into the mind of your participants and see things from their perspective. So you can answer the question, what's in it for them? What language works for them?
For a good recruitment process, just really think about what it is that you're wanting to find out from people, but also more importantly, what it is that you think they might get out of the experience. So think really creatively about that. It might not just be compensation financially, it might also be networks, connections, knowledge, capability, learning new skills, meeting other people who have similar experiences or ideas to them, and being able to have the opportunity to talk about that, which is actually quite rare in many spaces. And then, testing it out as well. So if you've got people who are similar in lived experience or professional experience or whatever it might be that you're looking to recruit, if you can run it past them first for some feedback, some critical friends, that would be great.
Recruitment done well with an iterative approach is not only a bridge to field work, but a key learning opportunity. You learn more about your participants, where they hang out, what they value, how to talk to them. And in many projects we've worked on, the recruitment strategies developed for research go on to inform the actual recruitment processes for the services and policies that we're designing.
I had to be reminded by my partner a while ago, who works in the health sciences, evidence-based medicine actually, and she reminded me, when I was kind of feeling frustrated about a human research ethics process I had to go through for this project where I was going to work with vulnerable children and those around them. And she said to me, just remember that there was a lot of cowboy research that was taking place for a long time on with human beings and nature and everything around. So you have to understand that, maybe it's become too strict now with ethics, and it takes so long to do anything that it might actually, are we even doing any? I mean, are we even helping the situation by how long some of these ethics processes take? So for me, I think just as a way of how we approach our work here at the Australian Centre for Social Innovation is we have our own sort of very kind of tight ethical principles that we follow that's in line with our sort of national guidelines that we have, primarily set by NHMRC, National Health Research Council, I think, if I'm right, or if I've gotten their acronym wrong. So for us, we align it to that, and we also align it to other sort of guidelines around what it means to work with our First Nations peoples and so on. So we have that as a foundational thing, and we always say that we're going to be working in line with that no matter what. But there are organizations who will want us to do a separate independent process sometimes, where the context is really sensitive and we are engaging with really vulnerable peoples. And in that instance, we might have to take there are two examples I can give you, where one example is where we had to curate a special group of independent sort of experts in an area of First Nations employment experiences, where we had to kind of curate First Nations sort of combination of experts in the employment space, policymakers, and even kind of academics and so on, and elders of Indigenous groups. And so then, bring that together and curate like a full-on, human research ethics process and go through that. And that takes anywhere between 6 to 12 weeks, it depends. And then I'll give you the other end of it, which is a full-on human research ethics committee which sometimes you can do through universities or hospitals, or there are one or two private groups in Australia who can support that for you. But basically, they have to be accredited by NHMRC to run their own human research ethics groups. And you then have to kind of do a full-on application process of like, okay, you know, who are you, like, what are you doing? Why are you doing it? You know, what are your approaches? What are you going to do with the data that you collect? How are you going to analyze it? How are you going to store it? How are you going to dispose of it? How are you caring for the people who you're meeting with? How are you caring for those around them? For example, in the instance of the school transport, how are you going to ensure that the bus drivers don't get a bad rap because if people are going to share bad experiences? How are they going to be safe? So what's interesting about a very rigorous independent ethics process is that they get you to really think through many scenarios before you even get a step out into the field. So in one way, if you come from a school of thought where I want to be really safe and I want to know everything about what I'm going to do in the field or in out there in the world, then maybe this will help you, you know, in a really nice way. It also aligns everybody really strongly. So it can kind of really set very strong foundations for you. But the challenge with that is you can't deviate a whole lot from the questions that you pose, the tools you said you're going to use, and the way you're going to, you know, do certain things like changing tact, you know, midway and so on. And in a place where sometimes the problem is ill-defined or it's a broad issue where you're trying to say, let's say, for example, you're broadly trying to understand what the culture of death and dying in Australia is. Like, I mean, you can't really say, well, you can still set some broad sort of parameters and, you know, ways of how you're going to be doing this thing. But let's say, for example, after half of the project, you're like, I think we need to change tact. I think we need to use something else. Like, then it becomes a bit tricky, like, to do stuff. So, but in very set, constrained project environments where you have a project for 6 months and you've been paid this much and you need to kind of like do it. So obviously you'll have to tell them how you're going to do it and so on. And then maybe an ethics process is pretty useful. But I find it, as long as you don't take any of the feedback that comes from people personally with ethics, you know, it's great. Like it's they're all caring for the people who you're going to be engaging with. And so they're going to be asking you very sometimes pedantic questions, but they're useful. It's rigorous and you can feel safe behind it in terms of making sure that you're not causing any harm. And even the group who's giving you the money to do the work, they also then feel really, okay, that's good. We've had that clearance. So now we can do this work. So in that instance of that national project, so they felt that having a clear sort of ethics done was valuable for everybody involved from a reputation and ethics and every other sort of lens.
And are there any particular challenges in getting design research methods through ethics committees that might be used to other approaches?
Participatory action research is well known. So people know that and whatnot. So you can always say, oh, well, we're going to use these methods and you just show some examples. The thing that ethics processes maybe struggle with is we might change that tool. We might change that generative tool based on what we've learned from a set of people. I think one of the biggest challenges we have with design research methods is the very abductive nature of like how we might make sense of what we observe and or learn from. In the kind of ethics process, they'll ask you to say, what is your method of analysis and synthesis? And then you say, okay, great, we're going to be doing some cluster this or something else here or some sort of language that we need to use, which then needs to match up to their worldview or their experience of how those things happen. So for me, I would say like that's something different in the kind of the design research world as opposed to say solid qualitative research coming from an academic lens. We're also not looking to write papers to have it peer reviewed and then have it critiqued and then be published. We're looking to really kind of do something to improve a situation and then an outcome for the people involved in that situation. I think
well-designed ethics processes are the cost of entry for legitimacy in certain systems, but they can be lengthy processes. The good news is that we've successfully been through ethics processes of that kind of standard even if they were almost as long as all of the other parts of the project put together. However, where there's the possibility to do so, it's worth seeking out creative alternatives to those kinds of lengthy ethics panels. A panel of people with lived experience, who, by the way, are often not represented on university-type ethics boards, can provide constructive guidance throughout a project as to what is ethical practice and what isn't. Building their capabilities in the foundations of design thinking will be important to ensuring this goes well. There are many ways to do design research. Many different methods are usually used in combination. The right combination being the combination that answers your key questions because they generate the information you need whilst creating a good experience for research participants. Talking methods are still a mainstay for design research. There are a few better ways to build a relationship. This is our auntie in residence, Auntie Vicky Charles.
This is what I would call yarning with a purpose. So we would come out and have a conversation and yarn. And it would be an intentional yarn. It'll be we're trying to find out information, but it's done in a yarning way. It's not done like a
formal,
like a survey, or we're not sitting there going, you know, how old are you, blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, it'll be just, I'll be having a conversation with Siobhan and I'll be like, oh, how are you doing today? Gee, you look like you're about my children's ages. And so I can start relating to you because I have children your age and, you know. So
it's find that alignment.
Yeah, to be able to have that conversation and then I can ask all these billions of questions. It was really funny. We did it with the... So I did it in my way with the deadly nanas in my bridge. One of the nanas who happened to be, there were three Auntie Vickies in the room that day, which was really weird because I never know any other Auntie Vickies. And one of the Auntie Vickies is like, I've got to go. When are we going to do this thing? And I was like, we've already done it. Like, she didn't even know that we found out all this information from them without it being, you know, we just were having a laugh and a yarn, and it's about letting that conversation be quite organic, but also knowing how to keep it back to the point. So some of the interviews, you know, would be like thing, and then someone would be off talking over here about, you know, thing, and then they'd mention something, and I might often say, oh, speaking of that, back here, I asked you this question and, you know, like, and say you can always bring it back in. You can always rein stuff back in. Anyway, that's what we call about, yarning with purpose.
Semi-structured interviews are one of the most frequently used tools at TACSI for design research. They are, surprise, surprise, interviews that have some structure to them and that have carefully shaped questions. But they're constructed and conducted in a way that makes sure that participants can lead the conversation. Often, semi-structured interviews provide containers for more activity-based methods, such as card sorting, or observational methods, such as show me what's in your fridge, or generative methods, such as draw your ideal experience. Often, talking methods in design research are supplemented by tools. For example, card sorting, that are used as stimulus for a conversation, for example, about what helps and hinders a particular situation or a particular outcome. Another favourite of ours is the timeline, asking people to describe the highs and lows of their journey. For example, their journey through employment and unemployment. We like this method so much at TACSI, we incorporated it into our recruitment process for staff, where we ask them to draw their timeline and their ups and downs and how that ends with them applying for a new role at TACSI. Semi-structured interviews, they usually take place in context and in a place participants are comfortable to be. That could be people's homes, workplaces, a cafe, or the park.
One of them was having to work with people who have really complex needs trying to access our welfare services here in Australia. And one of that was trying to connect with people who were classified as complex customers. It's really awkward language that the government uses. And I had to kind of, to do that recruitment, I had to connect and hang out with people in really diverse sort of contexts. But this one sort of wildest thing was I had to spend time with this gentleman who hung out at this kind of accommodation sort of service, kind of a non-government accommodation service. But he kind of volunteered for them, and he got a little bit of money for volunteering, you know, kind of supporting cleaning the area, but he also used their services. But then he had this ritual every day where he'd do that, he'd get his money, just kind of like a little stipend or like a little bit of money. And then his first trip was to go to the bottle shop, and then he'd buy himself a can of Coke first, and then, you know, a bag of wine. And then that's, by the way, that's about 9 o'clock at that point, 9 a.m. in the morning. And then he's then off to the park, where he's just kind of having a good time till about lunchtime, just mixing that combination of his can of Coke and the bag of wine. So I kind of, that was a wild experience, because I kind of asked him if I could kind of spend a bit of time to understand how he's accessing these things and who's supporting him, and just kind of trying to understand his world a little bit. Needless to mention, kind of sharing that mixture of Coke and wine with him, which was an interesting experience, and all his friends who came to do that. But I think there's no judgment on anybody's lives or anybody's experiences, but to really kind of go through what they're going through. But for me, I had to go to that sort of end point to really build a level of trust with him, to be able to say, oh, well, actually, this person's pretty cool. Like, they're not judging like what I'm doing or where I'm at. Like, they're happy to be part of my life in a genuine sense. So no worries, no problem. Yeah, I'm happy to have a chat with you as long as you follow my my day-to-day experience. You're cool. So I had to do that. I had to do about 4 attempts of hanging out with him before I could kind of even get to having a conversation about his experience with our welfare services, our sort of federal national welfare services, and what happened. So that's a one wild one. The second wild one is connecting with a family out in a remote Australian town called Lightning Ridge. They lived completely off grid. They lived on an opal mine, and I think they sort of hold business. Well, it's a family of 7 children and well, 2 families. Like, yeah, they're kind of partners. And that was a wild experience, because he was very, very skeptical of like having us visit and be with him in his sort of space. There's a lot of issues in small towns traditionally where people kind of have all kinds of interesting dynamics of trying to do things for themselves, but then others kind of judge them on the lifestyles or the kind of context they live in and so on. So it took about 3 attempts for us to really get to know him. But then by the 3rd attempt, it was, me kind of having a wild experience of like even seeing the opal mine that he kind of works on and digs up and so on. I think this is the first time I'm sharing this in a podcast, but I think insurance and safety things are all, you know, probably would have never passed for me to be part of some of those experiences that he was really keen to show me. But also staying on and kind of having their family dinner, which he then kind of hosted. I'm a vegetarian, but I think it was like this entire sort of meat display and offer. But I definitely had to kind of eat some of that. I kind of break my own sort of values and principles in these contexts too, in a sense that it's very special for somebody to kind of accept me coming into their context and sharing their life and their stories and their experiences. So I think it's important that I honor that trust or that openness that window of openness that they've offered to me. So
observative methods rely on looking and seeing how things actually play out. What do people actually do, or how does the service actually work?
But in another example of a project where it was about trying to see if we could design a national school transport, assisted school transport experience for children, students living with disabilities, especially really complex and diverse sort of needs. In that instance, for us, it was really important to actually have that transport experience in the bus or in that vehicle with a child. And this was very diverse, by the way. We did this all across Australia in 4 locations, you know, and really diverse regional, remote, rural contexts. And in some instances, you're sitting, you know, with a child where there's they're just being driven around in a car, and that's a four, you know, kind of like a four-seater car or sorts. In other experiences, it's a massive bus where, you know, seven or eight children are sitting, all of them with really diverse needs, and about two, three carers and support people in the bus along with the driver and so on. So it was important for us to observe what the preparation for the child and their family looked like before they got onto this bus, because there's a lot of anxiety for parents in general about, like, you know, getting children ready for school. You can have, I can pick up a phone and have a chat with the family, you know, kind of have a really good conversation and find out as to why it's so difficult to get their elder daughter to school. They have two daughters, and one daughter's got a very unique, very sort of rare, one in 100,000 sort of condition where they're still trying to work out what it is. And she's extremely violent and really physical and requires quite a lot of support and care from her father to be able to keep her safe in the car and kind of do it. They tried to get her to be on a school transport, like a kind of a shared bus, but she was being so, I suppose, disruptive or violent. It was like, when I say that, it's in the experience of others, but from her point of view, she's probably just trying to express something that she needs. And so that's still being worked out. So for us, going there, being in the house 1 hour before, when they were preparing this young person, you know, to get ready for school, you know, it was just, the chaos and the disruption that the family has to work with, everything from punched holes in the wall to broken sort of, you know, items, or like a torn bag, or that is the type of experiences observationally, and it as a phenomenon that you can't fully experience by just having a phone call or taking some pictures or even writing about it. So you kind of have to be in person and see how you can understand that a bit better. And so in these observational contexts, we're also trying to get permission to really try and go, how can we best communicate what it is that we're observing and learning? Videos tend to be very strong. And so we were doing a lot of recording of what the experience of these children were like. So for example, attaching cameras to their backpacks or cameras to the wheelchairs, just to see what it is that they see, and at least what is it they see, because sometimes some of these children are just, you know, they don't get the same experience as you and I do, where you can kind of sit upright and look out of the window, you know, so they're kind of strapped onto things and whatnot. So So there's kind of really sensitive topics that we tend to work on and topics that might not be as sensitive. So for example, a really sensitive topic where we might require observation is, how is a child or a young person's experience when they've been removed from their birth parents? But what happens is, when they're with foster care or in other sort of types of care contexts in Australia, this is, when I talk about this, I'm talking about the child protection and or child safety and care system here in Australia. So in that instance, where it's really sensitive, you know, we might not be doing any observational work during an experience of when a child is meeting with their birth parents, and bear in mind, they only get a very short period of, let's say, 90 minutes or a few hours to spend with their child, once a month, sometimes once a week. It just really depends on what those orders are from the courts and so on. So in that instance, we choose observational techniques of just being paired up with the person who picks up the child and then takes them to meet with their parents. We tend to kind of have conversations of, like, what's the preparation for the child in the lead up to maybe getting into the car when they're going to go see their parents. And then we then kind of don't, you know, do any of that. And then we wait around. And then once they finish, we then go, what's that experience after they've finished? And so we kind of do a before and after.
A third set of tools, more specialized to design research, are generative tools. They try to get below the surface to understand what people feel, dream, and value about things. They often involve some kind of making and a reflection on that making. This could include tools like collage that try to get at what people are feeling about a particular situation. Or it could be a designing together activity. For example, let's draw something together, or let's use a kit of parts to build something, or let's experience something together. Not because you're going to design those exact things, but the act of designing and talking about what those things could be is a great indicator of what people value and dream about.
Yeah, I think a good example of that is the work that we've done a few years ago in the space of disability and accommodation, and looking at what good accommodation and support looked like. And so we had recruited through our partners a number of people with really diverse disabilities who came together. And just a note on that, I guess the recruitment and the preparation for enabling people to take part was to make sure that people who needed it had the questions in advance and could prepare their answers, who had access to the space, breaks and things like that. And we also, just creating that space for people with disability to come together and talk about what they wanted was quite rare as well, from what people told us. So just having that space was really valuable to people. So that was an incentive in itself to recruit people in. And then once they were there, we were having workshops. So we were all together in a space, and we'd prepared some really great hands-on tools. So we had really strong visual indicators of good and bad and in medium, so we could do some feedback and say we had some traffic lights. So we had green light for good and red for bad and green orange for need some improvement. So we did some role play and sort of really demonstrated what it could be like, which was fantastic because it's very accessible for other people to see what something looks like or could look like and then provide feedback. So people gave it a traffic light and rated it, and then we sort of moved on. We also set up some cardboard tools for people to play with where they could create roles on cardboard cutouts of people, and they had cardboard houses that they could make into what they thought good accommodation was. So really sort of tangible things without too much metaphor that sort of helped people literally draw and create what they thought something could look like. So that enabled them to create it and also to have conversations and communicate with each other in different ways.
Why was the lack of metaphor important?
So for different kinds of neurodiversity, it's important to be quite literal with what you're describing, because metaphor can get confusing and distracting when you might be sort of talking about the ocean when you're actually meaning something else in a system or a service role. So keeping it literal can help.
So one of the ways that we conducted research with young people in the Sticking Together project was a text message challenge, which sounds a bit simple, but it was actually, it was really rich what came out of it.
Taxi practitioner Carla Clarence, and we first met Carla when she was a client of ours, and we helped Carla and her team prototype with young people a new kind of coaching service to help young people find sustainable employment.
What was really important for us to try and understand is, what do young people actually want to talk about? You know, how does a coach really, truly build rapport with a young person? And so a group of young people agreed to sort of engage in a daily text message interaction with us, where we would sort of pose certain questions, they'd respond back, or they would send us photos of things about how they were thinking and feeling about work, about life, about what really mattered to them. And I felt like that became a real building block for the coaches that we actually ended up seeking out. And I think it also became part of what ended up being the principles of what does it actually mean to work with young people. And it was through just really lo-fi ways of just connecting with young people and asking them, you know, how do you want to connect with us? And that worked a real treat.
The methods we've shared here are just a small sample of the design research methods you can use. Really, designing your design research approach is a mini design project within a design project. Feel free to get creative and invent what you think will do the job in hand. But a word of warning. A common failure point for design research is methods that don't deliver the information needed to answer the key research questions. So whatever methods you choose to use, but especially if you're using something you haven't tried before, or if you're working with a cohort you haven't worked with before, add in a round of testing with colleagues or with one or two actual participants to help reduce the risk of method failure and get your corrections in early. Okay, you did great planning, you did great field work, you documented it well, and now it's time to make sense of it all. This is the exact part of design thinking processes where too many crimes against post-it notes are committed. Making sense of your research is always going to be somewhat messy. You do really need to immerse yourself into it and stay open to new possibilities. But that doesn't mean that making sense of research needs to look like a crime scene. Let your key questions focus you and focus your work, and give yourself time. For bigger projects, it can be much more effective to do multiple research and analysis loops, each with a batch of participants, allowing you to process a smaller batch of data and tweak any subsequent research activities. One part of making sense of design research is to sort what you've learned against your key questions, to start to identify patterns and outliers. The other part is to make these findings come alive through carefully selected quotes, videos, photos, stories, graphs, maps, etc., etc. An excellent opportunity is too easily left dead in the water because poor communication meant it didn't get noticed. In my book, a description of a good opportunity states concisely what is the actionable opportunity. It then backs that up with data, preferably triangulated from multiple sources. From your own design research, that might be quotes or videos or statistics, but also from sources beyond your own research. What does the literature say, or what has other large sample work said? In my book, a description of a good opportunity tells you why this particular opportunity is significant to the project in hand. It spells it out, usually by describing the potential implications of action on this opportunity or of not acting on this opportunity. A good opportunity has also got to excite stakeholders about its potential and galvanize them and the design team to act on it. So a well-described opportunity is one part creative analysis and one part compelling communication. And often, to deliver on that excitement means taking one step into the what-if phase of work, illustrating opportunities with an early stage, a what-if idea, as a placeholder for what will come next. How might we increase the reliability of water pumps in Kenyan villages? That's the opportunity. What if we built a more robust pump? Or what if we trained people to maintain their pumps more effectively? Those are two early stage ideas that illustrate the opportunities. We learnt that male desk workers are often hungry in the afternoons at work. How might we create a substantial afternoon snack for male office workers? That's the opportunity. What about a roast beef Mars bar or a yummy nutty protein ball? Those are the early stage ideas that no doubt have you now galvanized to act on that opportunity. I want to make a small caveat on this narrative about the importance of depth in design research, and it's a caveat that's peculiar to working in public systems. Unfortunately, many of our public systems are so bad at meeting the needs of the people they're supposed to serve that the opportunity to improve them is actually quite close to the surface. Look too deep and you risk missing those kinds of opportunities. What if services for Aboriginal people were designed and run by Aboriginal people? What if mental health services focused on prevention and healing? What if schools were designed to work for a greater variety of kids? What if prisons were places of healing and learning? What if people living in poverty had more money? I'm not saying that these kinds of opportunities are easy to act on, as the paradigms are so entrenched, but they are obvious and easy to miss opportunities that deserve their time in the sun.
After we get these diverse experiences from different people, what one of the things we do with anybody who chooses to participate in any of our work is we close the loop with them about what it is that we learned from them, and not just from them, but also from others. More often than not, people don't go back and share what they've learned with participants. And I think for us, that's a really big part of that recruitment offer and experience, where we close the loop with people to say, okay, firstly, this is what we've kind of heard from you, and this is how we're kind of expressing it, you know, what do you think and whatnot, and kind of really work that with them. But then also then show everybody else's within the consent context, of course, and just, you know, show them the diversity of experiences and challenges and opportunities that others have expressed, and how does that relate to theirs. And that kind of opens up their world a little bit to go, wow, this is, wow, you guys are doing this. This is important. Like, yeah, I wish you, I mean, more often they're just like, I'm really glad I'm not doing your work. Like that's what they usually say. So, and then you're like, okay, great. Okay. Yes. More hope. And then you move forward.
In this module, we've touched on a few of the common failure points in the What is Diamond. When design research ignores existing research. When it causes harm through unsafe or re-traumatizing design methods. When it's poorly planned, making analysis hard. When methods don't deliver the information needed to answer the key research questions because they haven't been tested. And when end users or beneficiaries of services are not actually included, but their proxies are, service providers or advocacy groups. So let's look at this the other way. What's good design thinking and doing in the What is Diamond? Well, the planning for it starts early in the project process. It builds on what's already known. It's framed by a small number, around 3 key questions. It chooses the best fit methods to answer those questions from conventional research and from design research. It carefully selects the cohorts most likely to be impacted by the work as research participants. Within those groups, it carefully selects a diversity of people along a number of dimensions. The research conducted is ethical, culturally appropriate, and part of that is involving informed consent. And involvement in that research process for participants actually creates real value, for example, through reflection, through learning, through financial reward, or other things. Good design research gets below the surface to what people know, feel, dream, and value. And at the end of a good what is phase, you identify grounded opportunities triangulated by multiple data sources from your own design research, but also from others' research and from other large sample research. These opportunities are then communicated in ways that excite interest and galvanize action around them. And finally, good work in the what is stage loops back to research participants to tell them what's been learned and let them know about the impacts of their contribution.